Welcome, everybody. My name is Adam Liptak. I cover the Supreme Court for the New York Times. The formal title of the session today is Criminal Law at the Federal Level. I like to think of it as some conservatives who are soft on crime. You know, that's not entirely fair, but maybe that's what you expect from the New York Times. We're going to talk about some serious and fascinating issues, and I think there may be some different perspectives from our very distinguished panelists today. And there are, you know, authentic questions about the vast reach of federal criminal law, a fairly recent development. We're going to follow the standard panel discussion template with maybe just a slight tweak. Brief, maybe 10-minute presentations from each panelist. And then given that I anticipate that Mary Beth may be at odds with her co-panelist, if she wishes, she may have a brief rebuttal. Let me give the briefest of introductions. There are extended bios, and each of these panelists has done so much interesting work that I can possibly touch on it all. So look at those bios. I'll just give you the briefest of introductions. We'll hear first from George Terwilliger, a partner at Morgan Lewis, who has served, among other things, in many capacities in the Justice Department, including as United States Attorney, Deputy Attorney General, and Acting Attorney General. Then from Mary Beth Buchanan, who is now Ethics and Reputational Risk Officer for the United Nations, but served for 22 years in the DOJ, and for 8 of them as United States Attorney for the Western District of Pennsylvania. John Malcolm has had a series of jobs in the government and the private sector, and I'm most impressed by his title, which I don't know how you fit onto a business card. It is the Rule of Law Programs Policy Director and the Ed Gilbertson and Cheryl Lindbergh Gilbertson Senior Fellow in the Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial, Judicial Studies of the Heritage Foundation. So that is an exceptionally good title. Let's start with George.
Thank you, Adam, and thank you for being here. Thank the Federalist Society for undertaking this initiative, which I think is a critically important discussion, even more important now than when the idea was first conceived as sort of some of the dimensions of the expansion of the federal establishment are coming home to roost and be clear in terms of the impact on individuals. And I thought the comments from both John Turley and David McIntosh and Ted Cruz a few minutes ago about the liberty being the cornerstone of our constitutional and federalist system right on the money. And this panel on the impact of the criminal law, of course, nothing impacts liberty as much as being put in prison. So we're sort of right at the heart of the matter here. But economic liberty is also affected by over-criminalization, and the deprivation of economic liberty is a drag on economic expansion, growth, and sustainability. I won't go through all the statistics again, which I could, but I thought that was so well covered a moment ago. What I want to do and what my job here today is to kind of set the table a little bit on how did we get where we are. I think the other panelists will talk a little bit more about where we are from their perspective, but how did we get here in terms of the current reach of federal criminal law into the lives and the businesses of Americans? The reason for doing that is not just a matter of perhaps historical or legal policy interest, but also because it frames, I think, where we ought to be as opposed to where we are. And by tracing very briefly that development, perhaps shows us a path back. But let me begin with a proposition, and Adam actually made reference to it in terms of being soft on criminal law. Not at all. I was in the Justice Department for 15 years. I had a reputation, deserved or not, as a tough prosecutor, including on white-collar crime. But the kinds of cases that we choose to bring and the laws that Congress decides to enact
ought to be framed by reference to the constitutional role of the federal establishment when it comes to commerce. Criminal law has a place, but that place is to protect the means and instrumentalities that are necessary to commerce, not to become a super powerful regulatory tool through criminal enforcement. The reliance, in fact, on criminal sanctions to enforce an increasingly Byzantine set of regulatory standards is offensive to principles of fundamental fairness. Supreme Court has said it over and over again. David and others alluded to this. People ought to be able to understand what they're either required by the law to do or prohibited by the law from doing before they're held to answer under a penalty for failure to meet either one of those requirements. And all you have to do is sit down with any set of federal regulations, listen to the testimony of experts who will disagree about the interpretation of those regulations to realize that that standard is ignored on a daily basis in the context of enforcement proceedings. So how and why did we get where we are? First of all, there can be no doubt, I think, and I won't belabor this point, Hamilton probably wrote on it most extensively and most eloquently, that the reason we have a Commerce Clause in the Constitution, among other things, is in fact the recognition that commerce provides for the wealth and therefore the strength of nations. As Michael Novak put it in the 20th century, the invention of a market economy in Great Britain and the United States revolutionized the world between 1800 and the early 20th century or mid-20th century more than any other things. And as he so put it so well, after five millennia of blundering, human beings finally figured out how wealth may be produced in a sustained and systematic way. We shouldn't mess around with that too much. And that is exactly what we're doing by having the federal establishment shift from having its primary focus to protecting the means and instrumentality of commerce to regulating commerce through criminal means. And again, I want to emphasize that federal criminal law, which punishes fraudsters, hucksters, liars, cheats, and others who abuse the free market system, are good things to happen. It's appropriate. It's consistent with the founders' intent. And simply put, a dishonest market cannot be a free market. But the paradigm shift to where we are today began in the first half of the 20th century with a number of progressive and New Deal era reliance on criminal law to regulate corporate behavior. And there's three critical Supreme Court cases that I just want to touch on. New York Central and Hudson River Railroad, which was decided in 1909, held that respondeat superior could go a step further to allow for criminal liability of corporations. Now, Congress has since enacted a law making a corporation a person for purposes of criminal law, but that simply codified this decision. In 1922, the court decided United States versus Balint, which recognized the abandonment of common law mens rea requirements, in essence to permit, quote, prosecution under statutes the purpose of which would be obstructed by a mens rea requirement. That is a huge step away, because in the entire history of Anglo-American jurisprudence, what defined a criminal offense from much other kind of conduct was having a guilty mind. And then in 1943, in United States versus Dodderwich, the court heeding, quote, the admonition that the meaning of a sentence is to be felt rather than proved, end quote, held that criminal intent is altogether unnecessary in the corporate context in the enforcement of certain statutes. And Congress has followed this lead in enacting a law. So where does this get us? Congress creates the broad outlines of criminal liability which turn into a morass of regulations requiring corporations and individuals to understand the minutiae of these highly technical regulations. So, as you know, the way it works is Congress empowers agencies to write regulations with broad statutory objectives. Then the regulators write these regulations, and then both through statutes of general criminal applicability, like the Federal False Statement Statute, Conspiracy to Defraud the United States, and other statutes, as well as specific criminal violations that exist within these statutory schemes, the regulators are actually defining the crimes. And there are numerous cases, as Senator Cruz mentioned, stories are wonderful. One of my favorites is United States versus McNabb, the Honduran lobster case, where a lobster importer was indicted on 47 counts of conspiracy, smuggling, money laundering, and violations of the Lacey Act, which governs wildlife, which prohibits the importation of fish or wildlife taken, possessed, transported, or sold in violation of a foreign law, here Honduran law. The only problem was when that case actually got to court, the Hondurans came in, the defense produced an expert witness, said, gee, you know, that's not really what our law is. But undeterred, the federal establishment marched forward. One of my other favorites, and I'll conclude with this example, is United States versus Whiteside, where the 11th Circuit, in a ray of sunshine, rejected the prosecution of the defendant hospital administrators under 18 U.S.C. 1001, which is makes it a crime to make any false or misleading statement to a federal agency on a matter within its jurisdiction. The court rejected those convictions for making false statements, where the false statement was an allegation that they filed a single report classifying debt interest in terms of how the debt was used at the time of the filing the report rather than at the time of the debt origination. And expert witnesses actually testified in the trial of that case to differing interpretations. And the court said, you can't convict somebody where the experts can't even agree on what the law requires. So where can we go from here in terms of walking some of this back? I don't think we are just standing in front of an inevitable tidal wave that cannot be rolled back. A rededication of the federal criminal law to principles of not only fairness, but laws that require knowing and intentional conduct would be a major first step. Secondly, we can look and hold the Congress accountable for when it talks about enacting a new law, whether it's Sarbanes or Dodd-Frank, of going back to the notion that we shouldn't regulate commerce through the application of criminal statutes. The principal focus of our legal efforts should be to promote the means and instrumentalities of commerce and protect those means and instrumentalities. After all, entrepreneurial risk-taking, which is the heart, as you know, of American commerce, can only thrive so long as it is nourished, and regulation through criminalization undermines that. Thank you.
Mary Beth?
Well, thank you very much. I don't disagree with everything that George has said, and I'm sure that I will not disagree with everything that John said. Being asked to be on this panel was a very interesting proposition, because I realized that we're all former DOJ prosecutors, but I'm the one person who is going to sit here before you and tell you that what we did was entirely appropriate and we exercised our discretion appropriately, and these guys have, I guess, just disagree now. But, you know, there clearly is a role between the civil laws, the administrative laws, and the criminal laws. And it really is a very difficult balance. When you look at this whole area over criminalization, who can hear that term and say, we like over criminalization and we want more of it? You know, certainly we don't. I think that we have to look at where we are today with the growing numbers of criminal laws, and particularly the growing numbers of regulations, and figure out, you know, as George suggested, how we got here and how we fix this problem. And I think after listening to the first session this morning, I'm going to take the position now that the problem isn't so much with the executive's enforcement of the criminal laws. I think the problem really lies in the complexity and the vast number of new and growing regulations that are enacted every day by the agencies. The executive branch, and certainly this is the executive branch review, we can't forget that it is the role of the executive to enforce the law and to choose the appropriate mechanism for enforcement. And in many circumstances, the regulatory agencies are doing that, and they're doing that on a daily basis. And while every American citizen isn't going to know every regulation that is promulgated, the people and companies are going to be familiar with those that affect their industries. No one is going to be familiar with every regulation across every sector. In addition to what goes on every day in the regulation and the administration and the conduct of commerce, you also have the role of the criminal prosecutors, the Department of Justice, the state prosecutors, and we're continuously looking at what is going on in commerce, and we're looking at, you know, preventing individuals from being victims of crime, preventing companies from being victims of crime, preventing the government from being the victim of crime, preventing the taxpayers from being the victim of crime. And in many of these circumstances, in order to make sure that we do have a level playing field where companies are conducting themselves in accordance with the laws, we have to use the criminal tools to do that. And I'm going to give you a couple quick examples, and you decide whether it's an improper regulatory enforcement tool, as George referenced, or whether it's an appropriate use of the criminal statutes. And just quick examples. And most of these cases, and these are from my own personal experience, came to us from referrals from within the industry. In one case, we were dealing with a specialty steel producer who had bid on far more contracts than they had the capability of complying with. And in order to supply those contracts, they had to get more raw materials than they could produce themselves and more than they had access to in the market. So they went overseas, they acquired foreign cord wire from France. When they imported it into the United States, which they could import it, but they couldn't use it for the steel process. So what they did, they took off the labels that said made in France, and they slapped on made in USA. So clearly, you have a company that acted in a manner that was inconsistent with the regulations. It was inconsistent with the criminal statute, and it was clearly an intentional act. And as a result of committing that intentional act, it was able to secure contracts that others did not have access to because others were not violating the law. Another quick example in the environmental area in which, you know, these laws are never popular, particularly with this group, because, you know, you look at the strict liability component, and the laws tend to look from the outside as though you're applying very, very strict guidelines to companies that are, you know, not intending to violate the law. But if you look closely enough, there are many situations in which companies do intend to violate the law. In a case involving a business that was hired by a local municipality to rehab public housing, and they had to remove asbestos and remove lead paint. So their method of disposing of the asbestos was to dump it over the hill. And that was a lot cheaper, and it was a lot quicker, and they didn't have to get permits to do it, and they were able to get the job done a lot faster. With the lead paint abatement, you wash down the walls of the building with this very toxic chemical, and then you end up with barrels of wastewater, and you have to dilute that water before you can pour it into the, you know, into the river. And so these employees weren't given proper instructions on how to do that. And so they were basically dipping the cup in the bucket and testing it, you know, from the very top layer to see whether it was, you know, diluted properly. So not only were they not doing the job properly, but they were putting their own employees at risk. And we actually put these guys in the grand jury and talked to them about what they had done and felt that, I mean, I almost refer to it as the Jethro defense. They didn't realize what they were doing. And so we did not hold those individuals accountable, but we did hold the corporation accountable because they knew what they were required to do, and they did not comply, and they had an unfair advantage. There are all sorts of other laws we could look at that no one could disagree with. Many of the terrorism laws, many of the material support cases can only be brought through the federal criminal system. Even something as simple as our immigration laws, visa overstays, that is not a crime. I mean, that's an administrative violation. Six of the 9/11 hijackers were visa overstays. And, we're looking at that, the whole immigration system, to figure out when we can allow our administrative laws to control and when we need to use the criminal law system. Now, we've also had other cases on the other side, and I'm going to give you a healthcare example, where we had a physician who was an oncologist, and he was providing chemotherapy to his patients, and he was taking part in an HHS program that allowed him to acquire inexpensive chemotherapy. He was supposed to be using it for low-income rural employees. His practice was located in a county that would be considered low-income and rural. However, it bordered a very affluent and non-rural community, and those were the people that he was using the chemotherapy for. He also, in many cases, didn't even give many of the patients the full dosage, so we kind of looked at the course of his conduct to decide what was the appropriate means to address the conduct. In the end, however, the healthcare regulations were so confusing. After a 2-week jury trial, the jury could not decide because the regulations were very complicated. It was a hung jury, and it ended in a civil violation. So that can be an example where regulatory schemes are so complex that the criminal law is totally ineffective because the regulations really are far too complex, even for sophisticated individuals to comply with them. So what do we do? What is the answer? I mean, I think that we have to keep in mind here that we do have three branches of government, and we have three different areas of responsibility. Congress should be continuously looking at the legislation that they're enacting each year, whether this is necessary, whether there were other statutes in place that maybe could have been amended instead of enacting entirely new legislation. They should continually look at the legislation that is on the books and determine whether it's still necessary. However, this isn't 1790, and business and commerce is far more complex today than it was at that time. And while companies can look at some of this legislation and think that it is overburdensome, on the other hand, some of this legislation is also being used to protect intellectual property interests, to protect them when they're doing business overseas, to protect their trade secrets. So the law cannot be all bad, and we have to look at how it's used and what are the purposes for which it is used. And I have one suggestion that I think I'd like to leave us with. We have put responsibility on companies to make sure that they have compliance programs in place to prevent violations of law from occurring and to enable them to detect those violations of law. And maybe we ought to put the same responsibility on regulatory agencies. I mean, as they continually produce these voluminous regulations on an annual basis or sometimes more frequently than that, maybe Congress ought to put the responsibility and burden on the regulatory agencies to have to continuously monitor their own regulatory structures and continuously review them and determine whether they are appropriate and effective and to to change them when they're required. So that's my suggestion.
Thanks, Mary Beth. John?
I think that last suggestion is a great one. Good luck with getting an agency to take a hard look at itself and trim itself back. Let me take a step back and sort of talk about why I think overcriminalization is a big problem. And it's certainly a problem for corporations, but I also want to talk about how it's a problem for individuals. Let me begin with with the story that happened here in Washington, which is that in April 1940, then Attorney General, later Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson, was addressing a room full of prosecutors. And he told them on that occasion that they were, quote, one of the most powerful peacetime forces known to the known to our country. And he continued, the prosecutor has more control over life, liberty, and reputation than any other person in America. His discretion is tremendous. What Attorney General Jackson said then is certainly true today, if not more so. Now, as you've heard, I was at the Department of Justice, as were my colleagues, for a number of years, and I have a very, very high regard for most of the prosecutors whom I've met. No soft on crime, bleeding heart am I. However, I do recognize, though, that overcriminalization is a very serious problem and that its victims are all too real. Now, what do we mean by overcriminalization? We've been hearing that term a lot this morning. What I mean by it is that it involves the misuse and overuse, sometimes both, of criminal law and penalties. Now, looking back a little bit of history, our ancient history, if you will, under the common law, although this was the case for much of our history, under the common law, there were only a handful of offenses, such as murder, rape, robbery, arson. Every one of these handful of crimes was widely recognized as being morally blameworthy conduct. They were all what lawyers would refer to as malum in se offenses. And for most of our history, in fact, there were only a handful of crimes, and they were almost all malum in se offenses. So everybody knew that these actions were wrong, morally wrong. If it also turned out that you didn't know it was a crime and discovered it was a crime, you could truly say, well, ignorance of the law is no excuse, because you knew you were doing something that was morally wrong, and the fact that it's also a crime shouldn't surprise you. Today, on the other hand, you have buried within the U.S. Code approximately 4,500 statutes and another 300,000, possibly more, federal regulations with potential criminal violations attached to them. In fact, there are so many criminal laws and regulations that a dirty secret is that nobody really knows for sure how many there are, and there are dozens more being created every year, and that is just at the federal level. Every single one of these new laws and regulations gives prosecutors more power. Most of these new laws are not malum in se laws. They are malum prohibitum offenses. They don't violate any kind of moral code on their face. The only reason that these are offenses is because Congress or some regulatory agency has said that they are, not because they are prohibiting inherently blameworthy conduct. These laws now touch virtually every aspect of our lives. The food we eat, the property we own, how we run our businesses, and a lot of routine activities that we engage in. Unlike malum in se offenses, malum prohibitum offenses, regulations do not prohibit conduct. In fact, they allow conduct, but what they do is they circumscribe it. They say who can do it, how it can be done, under what circumstances it can be done, and often these regulations are so Byzantine that it's very hard for a non-expert to understand. When criminal penalties are now attached to violations of obscure regulations, overcriminalization problems ensue. There's an even bigger problem with all of this. It used to be the case that before somebody could be convicted of an offense, a prosecutor would have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant committed some act which constituted a violation of a criminal law, the so-called actus reus, and that they did so with a guilty mind, that they knew that they were violating the law, that they acted with the requisite mens rea. Today, a lot of these criminal offenses, statutes and regulations, lack an adequate or, in many cases, any mens rea, meaning that a prosecutor doesn't have to prove that the accused knew that he was violating the law in order to convict him. And when that is the case, accidents and innocent mistakes can become crimes. So, for example, to convict somebody of violating the Clean Water Act, a prosecutor only has to prove that the accused did the physical act which constituted the violation of the offense, not that they knew about the law or had any intent to violate the law.
Many of these offenses today are now so arcane that it is incomprehensible for a reasonable person to know whether what they are doing constitutes a crime or not. And as a result, many morally blameless individuals and companies end up committing acts that constitute criminal offenses, and some of them end up getting prosecuted for them. When a guy like Abner Schoenwetter, that was the lobster Honduran importer that George referred to, when a guy like Abner Schoenwetter ends up spending 6 years behind bars for importing lobsters in plastics rather than cardboard boxes, and for allegedly violating a Honduran regulation, which, as George said, the Attorney General of Honduras later disavowed and said it had never been effectively promulgated, for importing lobsters that are supposed to be marginally too small, that's a problem. The federal government pursued a case against the Gibson Guitar Company that got a fair amount of press, also under the Lacey Act, which, you know, makes it a crime to violate flora and fauna, not in violation of U.S. law, but in violation of some other country's laws. So Gibson Guitar got prosecuted for importing wood for guitar frets that was allegedly in violation of Indian export laws and Madagascar export laws. The Madagascar export laws weren't even written in English. The city of Palo Alto, California, went after a 62-year-old grandmother named Kay Liebrand because the bushes on her property, she got arrested and charged, because the bushes on her property routinely exceeded the 2-foot height maximum that the city had put in place. The government charged a guy named Robert Eldridge Jr. with violating the Marine Mammal Protection Act for freeing a whale that had gotten caught up in his commercial fishing net, rather than reporting this incident to the federal government so the federal authorities could come out and free the whale. I could give you lots and lots and lots of examples. And in fact, you have on your chairs a new publication that Heritage has come out. There's a website where you can get even more stories called USA versus You. It's got about 22 stories in there of unjust prosecutions. I would commend it to you. So when morally blameless people end up getting unwittingly caught up in this spider web called over-criminalization and had their lives adversely impacted, perhaps irreparably, the public's respect for the fairness and integrity of our criminal justice system is diminished. And that is something that we should all be very concerned about. Now, a frequent retort of prosecutors is that we shouldn't worry about this, that prosecutors are bright people and ethical people, and that they're very, very busy, and that we can just trust them to come up with deciding who deserves to be prosecuted and who shouldn't be prosecuted under, you know, using vague criminal laws. I know this argument extremely well because I used to make it myself. Upon reflection, though, I have come to the conclusion that that is a wrong argument. And it's not because prosecutors are inherently untrustworthy or that they're somehow bad people. It's because that approach is fundamentally unfair and it undermines the foundations of our legal system. It is not the part of a prosecutor's constitutional function to draw the line between lawful and unlawful conduct. That is the job of the legislature, and the prosecutor in that process is not a disinterested player. There are, after all, lots and lots of incentives for prosecutors to file charges, and there are very few incentives for them not to file charges. Prosecutors get a lot of kudos for bringing cases, and they rarely get praise for declining prosecutions. Many, in fact, most prosecutors are people of goodwill, but as is the case in any profession, there are some good ones that exercise good judgment, and there are some bad ones that exercise bad judgment. And they sometimes succumb to pressure, like the rest of us, to bring cases that they shouldn't bring. When you boil it down, the government's trust us argument essentially asks the public to bear the risk that prosecutors are always going to do the right thing. And that shouldn't be permitted in a system such as ours that is a government of laws and not men. Again, I'm not meaning to denigrate the motives of the people who keep us safe and engender respect for the rule of law. Much, if not most, of the blame for this belongs at Congress's doorstep for passing vague laws and for empowering unelected bureaucrats to implement nebulous regulations with criminal penalties. However, I will say that when law enforcement officials investigate and prosecute otherwise law-abiding citizens for crimes that no reasonable person would have known was a crime, they end up doing more harm than good. Well, what can be done about this? A couple of quick suggestions. First, it's important to remember that not every bad result has to end up in a criminal prosecution. If somebody does something unwittingly that somehow results in harm, there is no reason why that person can't be treated, perhaps severely, through the administrative system or through the civil justice system. That way, victims would be compensated, a general deterrence message would be sent out, and you wouldn't end up saddling somebody with a criminal conviction. The other thing is that legislators should resist pressure to respond to some sensationalistic headline that exists and just rush out to do something. If something is already a state crime, unless there is a unique federal interest, there is no reason to make the same kinds of conduct a federal crime in addition to being a state crime. And legislators should also resist the pressure from lobbyists who are representing special interests to, via regulation, literally criminalize the conduct of their competitors in order to gain some kind of a competitive advantage. And the last thing I would say is that honest mistakes should not result in prison time, that absent extraordinary circumstances, prosecutors should have to prove a mens rea. And Congress should go about the task of enacting a default mens rea defense, which is to say that when you have statutes and regulations where the element of a mens rea is missing, a default standard should apply, should be inserted, unless Congress makes very clear its intention that they really want to create a strict liability offense, which they can if they want to do so. And with that, I'll open it up.
I wanted to add one thing to what John just said that I think is important. A corollary to the principle I mentioned before about the people of ordinary intelligence ought to be able to understand from the law what they're required or must refrain from doing. One of the elements of due process that is part of that principle is that by having clear standards, it prohibits discriminatory enforcement of the law by prosecutors because everybody knows what a violation is rather than having prosecutors define those violations. I just heard a talk by a woman named Lauren Stevens, who was a regulatory lawyer at GlaxoSmithKline in charge of their FDA practice. She was prosecuted and went to trial for making false statements to the federal government in a series of letters that were written in exchange with the FDA on FDA information request. She was subsequently acquitted by the judge on a motion for judgment of acquittal on the basis that no reasonable juror could reasonably conclude that she had the intent to commit a crime. That is a perfect example of why the kind of vague regulations that John is talking about do in fact lend themselves to discriminatory enforcement of the law by prosecutors and is one of the real dangers of where we have allowed ourselves to get to in all of this.
Mary Beth, is there any daylight between you and your colleagues on this?
Well, you know, I read about the case that George just referred to, and it is troubling in which a lawyer was acting in her capacity as counsel for Glaxo and provided information to the government and was charged for obstructing the investigation, the prosecution. That should be chilling to any lawyer. However, we got to step back and say, what was the information that she provided? What information did she have? What should she have known? You know, can you view this as, you know, based on what information she gave, an attempt to obstruct the investigation? And I think without having all that in front of us, you know, we don't know. We don't know how reasonable people could disagree about that. I disagree with John that not every bad result ends up in a criminal prosecution. Most of them don't. I mean, that's what prosecutors do every day. They look at the conduct and they try to decide what's the appropriate way to address it. They look at how it's already been addressed. And I've had many cases where I've had agents and assistant U.S. attorneys that I've had to say, no, I mean, we've got reasonable people in a room here and we can't agree whether this is a crime, so we're certainly not going to punt it to the grand jury. But if you don't want prosecutors exercising the discretion in whether a law as written has been violated, who's going to do it? I mean, the question comes down to intent of the actor. And if you look at, even under John's answer, if every crime was a specific intent with specific mens rea, you're still trying to figure out what was the actor's intent. And you have to look at it as many pieces of information as you can for the prosecutor and the grand jury to try to, you know, decide what that intent was. So it's not a perfect system, and it's never going to be. But I think that if we can look at the laws that we have and look at the regulations and say we need to step back and we need to slow down a bit and we need to determine whether we need all these laws and need all these regulations, I think that that is the reasonable way to address the situation in which we find ourselves today.
Just very quickly, I was referring to that Congress shouldn't race out to try to criminalize every bad act that happens, that not every harm needs to have a criminal penalty attached to it. And, of course, there are prosecutions in which they don't have to prove any intent or any mens rea, or the mens rea is very watered down. In cases in which they do have to prove willful conduct, that is an adequate protection. And prosecutors then should make the judgment about whether or not they can prove willfulness, and that's appropriate.
So I'd like to turn to your questions in just a second. I think I'll ask one or two of my own, but we have a microphone over there, and we'd love to get your thoughts as part of this conversation. I wanted, first of all, to ask John and George whether any elements of your critique of overcriminalization apply to state law overcriminalization, or is this a federal law problem only? Because John talked briefly about the incentives of a federal prosecutor. I might think that the incentives of an elected state prosecutor might be even more skewed.
It's a great question, Adam, and particularly given the local beat of your paper in New York. we've seen great examples of exactly what you're talking about in the resurrection, if I will, assuming it was ever really alive, of the Martin Act. And its use by state attorneys general, I won't get into names at this point, to go after people in the finance industry for allegedly fraudulent conduct. That particular law is so general and expansive in terms of its prohibitions that it could be Exhibit A if we were to try a case of laws that allow prosecutors to engage in discriminatory enforcement. You know, I hear what Mary Beth says about, you know, we're not going to send a case to the grand jury, but the cases do go to the grand jury. The Honduran case got prosecuted and presumably got through a system. You know, we're all for clean air and clean water and having regulatory standards. Let's just take, if I may, and I know I'm going a bit astray here from your question, but let's just take Mary Beth's example of the 9/11 hijackers. Really, what is the point of saying we should have had a prosecution of those individuals? No, what we should have had is a regulatory system that works, that identifies people who overstayed their visas and therefore are not in the United States illegally, who finds those people and gets them out. The idea that prosecution of those people would have been a way to stop their activities on 9/11 or even makes any sense in terms of an immigration regulatory regime to me is just crazy. The states, to go back to your question, Adam, can actually be far worse because they are not constrained in many respects, particularly prosecutors with statewide jurisdiction who are elected officials. They are not constrained by even the review mechanisms that exist in the federal system.
I would agree with that. The only point that I would, yes, it's a real problem at the state level too. And of course, Adam, you're correct that district attorneys run for office and they're all aspiring governors, and so they also have incentive to bring prosecutions, and sometimes prosecutions run amok, like the Duke LaCrosse rape case that fortunately ended up okay. I would, however, point out at least that under our constitutional system, states have the primary police power to protect the health, welfare, and morals of its citizens. They also have a very, very good idea about what sorts of crimes have the greatest impact on local communities. But in terms of overbreadth and, you know, enforcing crimes with a lack of mens rea and regulations run amok, those things also occur at the state level.
Yes, sir.
Michael Rossman, Center for Individual Rights, and I'd like to follow up on the last comment Mr. Malcolm made, because it seemed to me a lot of what the panel was discussing was indeed, as Mr. Liptak's question suggested, equally applicable to both state prosecutors and federal prosecutors. I want to ask if there's a particular problem with Congress passing federal laws, not malum prohibitum, but malum in se, things people know are wrong, but that are essentially state crimes, and I wrote a list of them. The Hobbs Act, the federal anti-carjacking statute. Did you know that we have a federal criminal law against female circumcision in America? We have laws, hate crimes, which essentially criminalize all sexual assaults, gun possession, drug possession, wire fraud even. Isn't there a problem with there being two different sovereigns being able to prosecute the same conduct and essentially state prosecutors abdicating their role as the primary enforcer of criminal law?
Let me ask Mary Beth to give the first response, because as you were giving a list of some of the cases where I think you persuasively said these are real crimes, I did think that asbestos disposal or fraudulent fashion labels might have been prosecutable at the state level as well.
Well, I don't think I had fraudulent fashion labels. It was wire imported from another country.
Well,
anyway,
listen better.
I think that the quick answer to your question, and we would be here all day if we tried to look at everyone individually, but there are certainly many areas of overlap between state and federal prosecution, like bank robbery, for example. You know that is a crime. Almost the exact same elements in one jurisdiction as in another. And in wire fraud, many of the same elements are present. But certain types of criminal activity, if it does cross state lines and it does affect commerce, is more appropriate for federal jurisdiction. And I think Congress can also equally look at certain kinds of...
Can you explain to me why is it more appropriate for a wire fraud crime to be prosecuted by a U.S. attorney as opposed to a state prosecutor?
Sure,
it's fraud.
I'll give you a good example of that. If you broke apart the entire transaction as it crosses every state line or every county, you would have multiple prosecutors trying to address the same continuum of conduct, and it can be more effectively.
And that's bad because?
It's bad because if you look at the economic use of resources, it is more effective to do it in one location. Another just quick point, we can all disagree whether certain things should or shouldn't be crimes, but we also look at some of these very quirky things like bringing in the wood for the Gibson guitar. It may not seem like a serious thing to us, but the country where that came from and their ability to enforce their laws may be very important to them. And we have conduct with other countries in which we want them to enforce our laws. And so I think that from the reciprocity standpoint, I think there are reasons why we may want to work more cooperatively with other countries.
Thanks. I see several people waiting.
Can I just add an answer there? It's a profound question that is definitely worth asking. The reason for the rationale, more than reason, for the current state of affairs in the division of responsibility is probably best explained by reference to innumerable black and white movies about the development of the West, where there's a crooked sheriff and an honest U.S. Marshal. The fact of the matter is that the states have not done a very good job of policing their own jurisdictions for corruption and organized criminal activity and that sort of thing. The federal bank robbery statute was passed not just because bank robbers like Dillinger were crossing state lines, but because they seemed to be immune to having their activities curbed under state authority. Ideally, I think in our federalist system, you are right. It is the states that should have they have the primary police power. There is no federal police power, and they ought to be engaging in that activity. That said, there is a role for the federal government, particularly in terms of national and transnational organized criminal activity.
Yes.
Thanks. Clark Neely from the Institute for Justice. I want to thank you all for a really interesting panel. So one question, my understanding is that under federal law, there is a provision under the Hyde Amendment that a criminal defendant can be reimbursed their defense costs if a judge finds the prosecution was frivolous, vexatious, or in bad faith. This also seems to actually happen so infrequently that it serves as no real disincentive. What would each of you have to say, or any of you have to say, about a law that put that power in the hands of a jury and allowed a jury to order the reimbursement of defense costs if the prosecution was determined to be unreasonable? And it seems to me this would be an interesting disciplinary effect, because then the prosecutor would have to worry both about, you know, their reputation for getting convictions, but also worry about their reputation for bringing up large costs for their office. And it seems to me put a lot of stock and a lot of faith in the jury when it comes to convicting defendants. Why not put equal stock and equal faith in juries and their ability to determine whether prosecution has been unreasonable?
It would be disastrous. And which prosecutor are you talking about? The one who actually took the case and went to trial, the supervisor who told him to do that, the supervisor or the supervisor who changed the indictment? I don't think a system of personal retribution for
What if it was just the United States?
No, it's the office. It's the office that authorized the prosecution, just as it is under the Hyde Amendment.
Well, first of all, I wouldn't put that in the hands of a jury. It's a separate question to which there's going to be a whole lot of information that's far more relevant than the evidence that's introduced in a criminal trial. So you would have to gum the system up with a whole set of separate procedures. This issue, and I'll be quiet so other people can address this, but I mean, this issue aroused a lot of passionate and I think intense debate at the time the Hyde Amendment was passed. It struck a balance between some competing interests in that question, but I will tell you, both professionally and personally, I don't favor the idea that we can reform the system by retribution against people who are, in essence, doing their jobs as well as they can. There are innumerable available sanctions for prosecutors who overstep their bounds and abuse the powers of their office.
I think it also have a real chilling effect, and prosecutors would only bring slam dunk cases. And along the way, there are certain checks and balances, albeit not a very rigorous one, in that you do have to get a grand jury to return an indictment. And yes, I suppose it's true, as some have said, that a grand jury would indict a ham sandwich if presented with a case. But at least if you have instances in which a prosecutor is withholding information from a grand jury or lying to a grand jury or doing something that is truly vindictive, then there are sanctions that are available.
Let's take Rachel back there.
If prosecutorial discretion is going to work or be a check, there has to be some understanding among the prosecutorial core about what the standards are. You know, what is the appropriate balance between government power and individual liberty? What are the, if there are going to be thresholds of some kind, what are those thresholds? And in some cases, the U.S. Attorney's Manual might address that. But I'm wondering, since all of you were hirers of prosecutors at DOJ, did you try to ask those questions of candidates that came to you for jobs to try to ferret out who understands the right balance, and then what did you do to instill that understanding in them after they were hired?
Sure. I mean, I could say that I did not want to hire people who were one-sided in their views, and the people that came to my office with the view that they only want to be a prosecutor and that's what they were born to be and they couldn't see the other side, I didn't want those people, because those are the people that really can get you in trouble because they see things so one-sided that they're not presenting, you know, the entire, you know, facts, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And so you want someone to do that. So we did look for that when we hired. We tried to assign mentors to people. We had regular criminal division meetings to talk about prosecutions, had a lot of training programs. And I do agree that, you know, as a former justice person, from what I saw as a career prosecutor as well as a presidential appointee, the vast majority really do try to do the right thing. And unfortunately, there's always going to be in any sector some people who are so ideological that they let their own self-interest get in the way of what they ought to be doing.
It's a great question, Rachel. And I suppose where, you know, on a personal level, I was closest to that was when I served as a U.S. attorney and was hiring frontline federal prosecutors. And I have always believed that the most important and most essential characteristic of somebody who is a good candidate to be an assistant United States attorney is good judgment. And so for me, in the interview process and through the process of evaluating candidates, looking at judgment was an important issue. But you still need a check on that, and I think John referred to this a moment ago. One of the things that we did when I took over that office was institute an indictment review process. So the judgment of one prosecutor would never result in an indictment being presented to the grand jury, but rather a small group of prosecutors would look at the case. And that acts as a pretty powerful filter on the overzealous exercise, for example, of an individual's judgment.
Maybe we have time for one more question, sir.
Can I go back there?
It'd be better. Thank you.
I'm Don Santarelli, used to be a Justice Department guy, like George.
Hi, Don.
And I want to bring a perspective to the table. I have for maybe 30 years served on the board of the National District Attorneys Association, state DAs, and their American Prosecutors Research Institute, which is their technical assistance side. And the dual sovereign issue is very important, as George said. Many state prosecutors have very limited budgets and limited capacity, and they depend on cooperation with the feds to prosecute cases which exceed their capacity. On the other hand, U.S. attorneys in many jurisdictions have standards and thresholds for bringing cases that are federally statutorily violations, but they go to the local DA to prosecute under the state statute, where they may have a lesser penalty, but nevertheless a resolution of the case. This relationship has evolved over the years. And to the extent that there's cooperation, let me cite you an example. We created at the NDAA a National Identity Theft Prosecution Center. The basic funding for it and the training for it is done by the federal government, basically the Secret Service, because they felt they couldn't get their cases prosecuted sufficiently in the federal system because the thresholds were often low in identity theft cases, and they were often localized rather than international in origin. So the search for perfection and the balance in dual federalism will go on. I just don't want you to miss the fact that state DAs really serve basically at the pleasure of their community. And if the DA gets a little bit out of whack and gets a little bit too outrageous, he can't stay DA without his local bar. They are the basic characters who judge the qualifications of DAs, notwithstanding the election. The feds get to appoint an occasional aberrant individual who has no responsibility except to himself and maybe to the Justice Department. But thank you for letting me make a comment as opposed to a question.
Let me just say, I want to be clear with my allusion to the black and white movies, that the point that that Don Santarelli makes is really well taken. I know so many, and in my days as both a prosecutor and as a justice official, state DAs that were completely frustrated by the lack of resources that they were accorded and who wanted to do the job and only came to the feds and somewhat reluctantly came to the feds because if you didn't get it done there, it wouldn't happen.
I would say there was a reason for the creation of LEAA 30 years ago, the Law Enforcement
Assistance Administration. We're just about to run out of time, so maybe we'll have a couple more quick reactions and then.
I would say this on the concurrent jurisdiction point, which is as Congress has expanded its definition of what constitutes commerce, and as modern technologies have now made it so the communications almost invariably through wires and mails flow across state lines, it does create this huge overlap between the two, which causes a couple of problems. One is if the Congress keeps passing all of these laws and declaring everything to be a priority, sooner or later there are no priorities if everything is a priority. And the other is that you do lose some sense of accountability. For instance, if there's gun violence in a community, is that the state prosecutor's fault or is it the federal government's fault? There's no clear division in which somebody can say, you have primary responsibility for this and you have primary responsibility for that if everything is a matter of concurrent jurisdiction, and that is a problem and does create overcriminalization problems, but I recognize also that there are areas of expertise and cooperation that can sometimes smooth those problems over.
Any last thoughts, Mary Beth?
Priorities are both national and local, and they have to coexist.
So this is such a rich topic, and these are the perfect people to discuss it with us. Please thank the panel.
Thank you.